We have finished our series on Elijah last week. I talked about his death and then the one more miracle that occurred after he was buried. You know, a dead body was thrown on top of his body and that person came back to life. So that was pretty wild. And it took me a little while to figure out what I wanted to talk about continuing on. And I found it yesterday. I pinpointed what I wanted to say, what I want to talk about in this class on Thursdays. I foresee that we're going to be having just a morning worship when we start out, and so we likely won't be having a Wednesday night study for a couple more weeks after we come back for worship, but whatever the case, I'll just take this class and do with it what I can. And so what I want to do is talk about the book of Ezra, and then hopefully we can make it to Nehemiah as well. Those two go hand in hand. But to be able to properly set the stage for those books, we have to jump back a little bit into the history book to discuss what was going on in Israel and why things kind of ended up the way they did. So this is going to be the book of 2 Chronicles chapter 36 that you see on the screen, or the box right here. And this talks about Judah's decline. So for the history, just keep in mind here, the north tribes that we're talking about before, when they split between north and south, you had Israel up north and Judah down south. Israel, the northern tribes, were taken away by the Assyrian Empire, and they camped out of Jerusalem, and then they were not able to take over Jerusalem and Judah through the Assyrian campaign, but the Babylonians were coming next. So if we look here into, again, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, beginning in verse 1, just so you know, we look at the book of 1 and 2 Kings before, right? And that was, as far as we can tell, written before the land of Israel was taken away in captivity by the empires. When you look at the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles, or the book of Chronicles, as it was one volume to begin with, that's thought to be, by most scholars, to be written after the exile and then during the same time of the events of Ezra and Nehemiah. So you got one history book that tells the events before they were taken captive and one that was written just when they were coming back from captivity, 70 years later. Going back and to kind of remember where they had been so they don't fall into the same traps, right? So it was good for them to have those two generations in captivity. Life was hard, but they, through that, learned that idolatry was not going to be tolerated by God. That was the overall message. And you don't see, obvious idol worshiping in Israel anymore after that because they, I guess, learned their lesson, right? So that's one thing to keep in mind here. If we look over into, again, 2 Chronicles 36, beginning in verse 1, it says, "The people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah." So you'll remember from a couple of weeks ago on Sunday morning sermon, we talked about Josiah the reformer. So this is his, the person who took up the job after him, "the son of Josiah, and made him king in his father's place in Jerusalem. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 3 months in Jerusalem." So not a very long career, right? 23-year-old guy, dies or is taken captive here in verse 3. "Then the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, deposed him in Jerusalem and laid on the land a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And the king of Egypt made Eliakim, his brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem, and changed his name to Jehoiakim." So it can get confusing pretty quick. The idea here is you have a king who is reigning in Jerusalem from Judah for 3 months, and then you have the army of Pharaoh all the way from Egypt deposing him. So they now have Israel and Judah in Jerusalem, that entire group there as a tribute land, right? So they are going to be reigning there, taking captive of the land, and they will let the people stay there for the, ransom, if you will, of those talents of silver and gold. So verse 5, "Jehoiakim from Egypt was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in chains to take him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also carried parts of the vessels of the house of the Lord's, the temple, to Babylon, and put them in his palace in Babylon. So this is the fall of Judah, if you will. You had a puppet king from Egypt reigning in Jerusalem for 11 years. Nebuchadnezzar came from Babylon. When they took over Assyrian empire, they beat them, and now Babylon's come and taken away the people from the land. Not everyone would have been taken away in chains. That's kind of one misconception that we read about a lot. Not literally every person in Israel went away to captivity. Many were allowed to stay and to work the land, and they were slaves, essentially. And then they would stay in the land, and they would marry other people that were in the land from other tribes. And so when you look at the book of Ezra, and they're bringing people out of captivity from Babylon, and not everybody leaves, by the way, and when they come back to Jerusalem, there's already going to be people there, but they're not the true seed line Jews that we were talking about there. That's where the Samaritans kind of come into play a little bit later on in history, is you have folks that were worshiping Jehovah God, but they had a different version of the Bible, the Old Testament that we would have had, and they have different rules about where to worship, which is what they thought you'd worship God on the mountain there, Gerizim in Samaria. And that's where, if you remember from the book of John, John chapter 4, meets a woman at the well, and her question was, you Jews say that you worship in Jerusalem, but we say here in the mountain, which where's the right place to worship? That's kind of fast-forwarding a lot, but that's kind of the beginning, the origins of this kind of, are you truly from the seed line of the Jews, or are you kind of a half-breed Samaritan? That kind of comes into play at this time as well. So, anyway, they take the items of the temple back as tribute. I mean, if you go there and you defeat their temple, you're saying our God of the Babylonians is more powerful than the God of Israel, right? So that's what they're doing, is they're taking those things back as tribute. Thankfully, they took them and they kept them, and they were safe for 70 years because they had to bring them back to Jerusalem when the Jews were allowed to go back home. So, verse 8, now, the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and the abominations that he did and what was found against him, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah, and Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his place. So they're saying, if you want more information, look at the book of 1 and 2 Kings, essentially. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he became king. He reigned for 3 months and 10 days. So, not a long career. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In the spring of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the precious vessels of the house of the Lord, and made his brother Zedekiah king over Judah and Jerusalem. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign. He reigned for 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. And this is where you'd say, if you want more information about that particular event, go read Jeremiah. It's a longer book, but that's why that's there. Verse 13, he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. By the way, the fact that you can reference in verse 12 that Jeremiah the prophet is talked about here, this implies to us that the author of this book lived after after the time of Jeremiah, right? Because you wouldn't be prophetically uttering the idea of, you know, there is this prophet in the future called Jeremiah that you probably heard of, and it's no doubt he's actually kind of got a copy of Jeremiah right there that he's able to read, right? So that's one thing to consider here, just logically. Verse 14, all the officers of the priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations. And they polluted the house of the Lord that he made holy in Jerusalem. So you have the officers of the priests, so the ruling class of priesthood in Jerusalem, and the people did evil, right? So you have it from the king to the priesthood to some of the prophets of God, and then the people themselves. That's how the triangle goes, or the rectangle goes, rather, of communication between God and the people. Verse 15. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. So let me read that again. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers. So he was sending messengers to the people to try to get them to change before things went too late. This is likely talking about prophets. There's maybe the perspective of an angel of the Lord being sent, because that word angel means messenger. So whatever the case, that's not what we're looking at. Verse 16, but they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at as prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, and then until there was no remedy. So the Lord knew that there was no more hope for Israel. They had killed the prophets that were sent to them. They mocked them. They laughed at them, despising those words that God was trying to send them about the future, and they finally met their end. In verse 17, therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or age. He gave them all into his hand. So this is one of the great points of contention, I guess, with some people, is the Lord is now using a sinful people to punish his faithful people. Well, his faithful people of Israel were all gone. They're not faithful anymore. And so they've finally been given these generation warnings from the prophets of what's going to happen if things don't change. Things didn't change, and here is the end result of that consequence. Verse 18, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasure of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. So Jerusalem has fallen here. They burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned up all of its palaces with fire and destroyed all of its precious vessels. He took in exile in Babylon those who had escaped the sword, and they became slaves to him and to his sons until he established the kingdom of Persia. So the Chaldeans became the Medo-Persian Empire, the Median Empire and the Persian Empire, they combined, and they were the ones that took over Babylon, right? Verse 21, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So there is kind of a play on words going on here. The Sabbath, or the seventh day of creation, the Lord rested, right? Not that he needed it, but he was establishing a principle of the idea of needing rest. And so he's saying here, I'm going to lay a Sabbath before the entire land of Israel, but not 7 years, 70 years. So not 7 years or days, but 70 years of rest. So kind of a fulfillment of that. Okay, verse 22. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, so Persia has now incorporated all of Babylon and all of Assyria. So Assyria was the first empire that was of great importance. And then they fell to Babylon. Babylon fell to the Medo-Persian Empire. And they will fall to the Greeks later, right, with Alexander. So that's kind of the history of that. That the word of the Lord of the mouth of Jeremiah, I'm sorry, verse, no, there it is. That the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put in writing, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, so that's the name of God, Jehovah, or Yahweh, depending on how you want to look at that, the tetragrammaton, that's a fancy word for it. The God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has changed me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you, all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. So Jeremiah wrote about, 70 years, 65 years before Cyrus ever lived. And he said that the Lord is going to have a messenger named Cyrus. He's going to be king, and he's going to let the people go back home. So that's the very end of the book of 2 Chronicles. And the way that Ezra begins, the book of study for us today, is exactly what we just read, just repeated. And so likely what's happening here, obviously, is they have someone writing 1 and 2 Chronicles. Some people think that must have been Ezra, because he was someone that knew this information well, and he's likely the author of the book of Ezra. And so because it flows so well, it's kind of like if you read the book of Luke and then the book of Acts, it's the same author, it's the same writing, and it flows from, hey, here's the life of Christ, Theophilus, to, hey, here's the Acts of the Apostles, Theophilus. So it's kind of similar to that kind of writing style. This is the ESV, the English Standard Version, and they have introductions before each book, and I want to be able to read the introduction, and then we'll probably call it a day for today. I want to give you some time to do some more study into the book of Ezra itself. I just want to kind of prep it by doing a quick intro before we got to the actual text. So here is the introduction to Ezra according to the ESV. The book of Ezra begins where 2 Chronicles ends. As prophesied by Isaiah, and that's Isaiah 44:28, the Persian king Cyrus had sent exiles led by Zerubbabel back to Jerusalem in 538. Persia defeated Babylon in 539. Remember the timeline, you go, the bigger the number is, the further you're going back in history, right? Because all BC. Despite opposition from the non-Jewish inhabitants of Judea, and after encouragement by the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the temple was rebuilt, 515. Then in 458, Ezra led the second of three waves of returning exiles. By the time Ezra arrived, the people had again fallen into sin. Ezra preached God's word, and the people repented. That's chapter 10 of Ezra. Ezra succeeded because God's hand was upon him. This book, perhaps written by Ezra, shows God's power and covenant faithfulness, moving even pagan kings to accomplish his redemptive purposes. He's using the idolatrous king of the Medo-Persian Empire to send Israel back home to rebuild the temple, to rebuild the walls, to rebuild Jerusalem. And that's so significant because we have all these prophecies about the word of the Lord, meaning the gospel, is sent forth from Zion, so from Jerusalem. And it will go from Jerusalem to all the regions that are surrounding it, Samaria, and then all the way to the end of the earth. And so if we want the Messiah to come to the earth and to save us from our sins and to establish a new covenant, there has to be a Jerusalem that's built for him to go and preach in, which we know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John reveal. There was a temple that was rebuilt by Herod close to the time of Christ, and that temple again would fall in the year 70 AD. And so Christ is trying to get the message, Jerusalem's a great place, but you're looking for God, not just the city, not just the temple, and you're missing that there is God in the flesh right with you. So that's why the temple was destroyed in AD 70, was to drive that point home. The temple is not a physical building, it's a spiritual place of God. So that's going to be our introduction to the book of Ezra. I have never taught this book publicly. it's a new book to me when it comes to preaching it. It's a long book. I don't like to just jump into Ezra or Nehemiah or any of the prophets, really, because what it does is you have to kind of know the history of the people in Israel, the divided kingdom. The north is taken by Assyria. The south is not taken by Babylon quite yet, but the Persians get, or the Babylonians get to the south, and then the Medo-Persian Empire takes over. All that intro of the last 35 minutes, I hate to just assume that people know all of that, because I didn't. And so when I looked at Ezra, I had no idea what was going on the first time. It took me a while to figure out the timeline and who was in charge and what was happening, and it took me a while. So that's why I want to teach this book, is because I neglect it because of that backstory that I sometimes have to just assume that people know. And most people would be hard-pressed to say they knew all of that before we started our discussion. If you have been a Christian for a long time, you've been to through history books before, and you study your Bible the way that you know we encourage you to, then this is probably old news to you. But for some people, this is a lot of information to take in, and I want to kind of give it in digestible forms as we continue to learn about the history of the people of God, and that encourages us that he's part of our history today, if we're paying attention. So that's kind of one point. Okay, so thank you for your attention this afternoon. That's a little bit quicker than my usual hour, but I wanted to kind of give you the intro. I would encourage you before next week to read the first couple of chapters. We're going to be going through this verse by verse, and so I kind of want you to have an idea of where we're going. So if you already kind of have it fresh in your memory before next week, that will make the revisit that we do together a bit more streamlined and efficient. So hopefully you're encouraged by the study. These books are extremely significant historically because they're written as history, and they actually took place, and a lot of this stuff is has to be written by God because mankind didn't know any of these details. You know, 100 years before he was born, Isaiah was talking about the king of Persia, which didn't really exist yet. So anyway, good stuff. Hope you enjoy. I'll see you guys next week, and I'll see you, of course, on Sunday for worship.